This is the Larry Mueller Show. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking about wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Knack. David is an Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and Jamie is an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. They are both affiliated with the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. Hi, David. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Jill. Great to see you.
Great to see
you, Jill, too.
Hi. We're going to talk about helping pollinators in Wisconsin, also the results of the latest ruffed grouse survey, and of course, take your questions. So give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So tell us about this new partnership to help pollinators in Wisconsin. Jamie, you want to take that one?
Actually, I think David's going to lead this one off.
Okay, sounds good.
I'll talk about this a little bit. So, so there's a partnership going on with the Department of Natural Resources, the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin, and the Driftless Area Land Conservancy. And they've teamed up to improve nearly 2,000 acres of pollinator habitat on both public and private lands in southwestern Wisconsin to benefit a number of federally endangered pollinators. So one would be the rusty-patched bumblebee, which is obviously in Wisconsin. We have it here in Madison area as well. It's found out at the Arboretum and other areas around Madison. Monarch butterflies, regal fritillary butterflies, and some other at-risk pollinators. And so the Natural Resources Foundation from Wisconsin got a $100,000 grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, and they're going to use that to restore about 267 acres of pollinator habitat and improve about 1,500 acres. So and that is primarily on public land, so state natural areas, wildlife areas, things like that. And then the money was matched by the Wisconsin Natural Resource Foundation's Pollinator Protection Fund, and most of that match will go to help private lands who are bordering or are adjacent to some of these state natural areas and some of the public lands. But essentially the goal is to improve, create and sustain a connected patchwork of habitat that supports insect pollinators and the annual migration of monarch butterflies. And monarchs have decreased by about 80% over the last 20 years. And this thought that primarily is due mostly to loss of habitat. So it's a pretty important project going on in the southwestern part of Wisconsin. And although it's a little odd for maybe a couple of wildlife people to be talking about pollinators, we do kind of lump them in with wildlife. And there's a lot of people who are interested. If you're interested in birds, there's a lot of people interested in butterflies particular, but other pollinators and things like that. And this this restoration action down in the southwestern part of the state will certainly benefit pollinators, but will benefit a whole host of birds, migratory and resident birds, but it'll also host, it will benefit, small to medium-sized mammals that will use that pollinator habitat for cover, and they can find food in there and things like that, as well as reptiles, amphibians, and things like that. So even though it's focused on pollinators, it will certainly benefit a wide host of wildlife as well. And so it's a really interesting project and just kind of interesting that, they're starting to put some focus on that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I was
Jamie,
just going to
go ahead.
Yeah. Quickly add that David's correct. You know, these practices that are good for pollinators are also good for many other wildlife species. And some of those for pollinators are simply using native species, native plants that the pollinators have evolved with, and often help support those populations of native plants, adding brush piles and leaf piles for these insects, and then also minimizing pesticide use in general, beneficial certainly for pollinators, but other wildlife as well. And then as we talk about citizen science opportunities a lot on this show, whether it's Snapshot Wisconsin or water monitoring and so on, but there is also a citizen monitoring portal for a number of pollinator species, but reporting observations of bees and butterflies and pollinators through the Wisconsin DNR. Just type in citizen science and there'll be opportunities where you can help support the science that the public can offer.
Absolutely. And we do have a link on our website to that press release from the DNR, giving you a little bit more information about where that is and what their plans are. And you can find that at WPR.org/Larry and just click on this particular show to get that information. Let's just jump right into the whole concern about the ruffed grouse population. That comes up a lot on our show. We've got some ruffed grouse lovers that listen to us. What did the latest survey find?
Well, they certainly are a species, at least in my mind, that definitely is iconic. I mean, the way the males drum, flushing one in the woods and hearing that thunderous sound as they take off and kind of startle you. Yeah, certainly a magnificent bird. And they do see a fair amount of research, but also interest in that they are a cyclic species. So they tend to cycle every 10 or so years with their populations. And I would say the data that we're seeing in the spring drumming count for this year is not alarming. It's I believe, you know, fairly what we kind of expected to see. And yet overall, the trends for rough grouse long-term has been a decline, but it's expected. So in 2020, we did not, or the state, the Department of Natural Resources did not complete the spring drumming count surveys because of COVID. So this 6% decrease, and that's statewide, a 6% decrease in the drumming surveys for grouse, that is comparing 2019 information to 2021 survey results. So we don't have that data point for 2020 to see whether, you know, that was a peak or, you know, or if 2019 was a peak. So typically their cycle follows a 10-year cycle with highs occurring in years that end in 9, 0, or 1. And it's likely that the population peaked in 2019 or 2020, and now we're going to start to see what we would call the down phase of the grouse. And so in, you know, we still expect in quality habitat, there are still going to be significant numbers of grouse. It's just, you know, fewer than those boom years up in the, you know, that we just witnessed here. So overall, the count or the survey, the drumming activity was down 7% in the north. There was no change in the central forest region. And there was a 33% increase in the driftless area where we were just talking about the pollinator project. So it's not, the increases or the decrease, I'm sorry, is not uniformly across the habitats of the grouse.
But we should add that most of the grouse in the state are concentrated in the northern forested region of the state. So yeah, that decline that they're seeing up in the north, that's why overall statewide you see a decline. And we should also maybe add what drumming is, or talk a little bit about what drumming is. So, you know, rough grouse are the males. This crown dwelling forest bird will stand on a kind of a rotting log and will beat his wings just repeatedly for, you know, seconds or minutes. And as he's beating his wings rapidly and repeatedly against his body, that kind of causes a concussive noise as he's trapping air there. And so that's what you hear, that this kind of this concussive or drum, what's called drumming sound. And then typically what the DNR does, and they do this in conjunction with tribal agencies and some other agencies, as well as citizen scientists, is that they have defined transects that they'll ask people to walk or drive. And along this transect, they'll ask them to get out of their vehicle and sit and listen for a known period of time. And then they will count the number of drumming males they hear. And so if you hear the same drumming coming from the same direction, that typically is the same male. But if you hear it from your right and then simultaneously or just shortly thereafter you hear it from your left, then they would count that as two drumming males. And then they'll sit at that point for a while, then move on to the next point in the transect. And the transects are the same routes year after year after year. So what they're getting is an index of drumming males from year to year that they can compare to see if it's going up, down, holding steady, or whatever the case is. And it's a pretty neat thing. It's also for, you know, people who are looking forward to spring, it's a nice sign that spring is coming, and you get to hear these birds out there drumming. So it's a pretty, as Jamie said, a pretty iconic, especially northern Wisconsin species.
And how long have they been doing those surveys?
Yeah, I did have that. Since 19... Oh,
it's a good 60s, question.
Wasn't it?
It was, I want to say 60s or 70s, and it was part of their press release.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not seeing it right in front
of
me.
So there's there's a lot of data. I mean, this isn't just something that's just happened in the last few years.
No, it's been decades of data. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. 1964 is when the roadside survey protocol started.
Okay, great. Yeah. Well, we have Carl from Mercer online who has a question about the ruffed grouse. Hi, Carl.
Hey, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I'm Mercer is in far northern part of north central Wisconsin, and it's been almost 40 years here, and we never used to have turkeys. We've got turkeys all the time now and a lot fewer grouse. And, you know, there's also no shortage of opinions on wildlife management and game management up here. And you'll oftentimes hear, oh, the turkeys, they're killing the grouse. And wondering about what the research says about predation on eggs or habitat utilization or competition for food resources. Is there any interaction there?
Yeah. Jamie, you want me to take this? Or?
Yeah. Sure, go ahead and I'll add.
Okay, yeah, please do. So, Carl, this is a very common follow-up question. When we start talking about grouse, it's very common to get the question about the turkey interaction. And so a lot of people will suggest, well, the increase in the turkey population in the state has actually is a cause and effect, and it's actually driven down the grouse population. And a lot of people, as you've suggested that there's nest predation by turkeys on grouse, or turkeys are running grouse out of the area, or whatever the case might be. And actually what it is it's a habitat-driven issue. So turkeys like wide-open, understory forested areas because they like to run. They would typically run or move away with their legs before they start to fly. And so they like to see the predators coming from a long ways away, so they get a running head start, if you will, to avoid predation. And so in areas where you have a forested understory, turkeys tend to avoid those areas because they don't have good sight lines. They can't see the predators from a long ways away. So what typically happens is when turkeys move in, that understory or the forested area has started to open up for a variety of reasons, but most commonly, and maybe not so much up north because your deer population isn't as high as it is down in the southwestern part of the state, for example. But where you have a lot of deer, you have deer browse, and deer are over browsing that forest understory. So they're really opening up the understory, and that then turkeys quickly follow the deer and will move in because that open understory benefits turkeys. Open understory does not benefit grouse because grouse are very susceptible to a wide variety of predators when that understory is opened up. So when grouse are around, you typically have a very thick understory, not a heavy understory. And so that's what's going on between the turkeys and the grouse. It's a habitat-driven or understory-driven issue. So as that understory opens up, the grouse are going to abandon it because they don't feel comfortable there because they're susceptible to predation. Turkeys feel comfortable there because they can see the predators much easier, and it gives them an easier advantage to get away. So, Jamie, anything you want to. And apparently there must be a tornado siren going off in Madison.
Actually in Watertown. Okay. that's my end. Sorry about that.
I guess the other thing just to point out that turkeys are opportunistic feeders. So the notion that they would not predate a grouse nest does not hold. Opportunistic feeders, they come across a grouse nest or a snake or anything like that. I mean, they're going to peck at it. They're going to eat it. But it's not that they're keen in on those nests and actively hunting them or pursuing them, looking for them. And they also have differences in terms of their feeding styles. Turkeys are a big bird. They're not going to do too much budding from tree limbs as the grouse will, and certainly have different preferences in terms of where their nest locations are too. So I don't think there's too much competition that way. I think it's more the changes or the difference in habitat over time. And as far as predation, we hear that one a lot as well. Just the number of predators in the environment has increased, and they feel that has drawn the grouse population down. And, you know, ecology would tell us that if we had the proper habitat and quality habitat, wildlife populations can sustain certain percentages of whether it be disease or predators, they can handle that with quality habitat.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Christina Myshock is our technical director today, and Jane Rotunda is our on-air producer. We're talking about wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Knack. Jamie is an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, and David is an Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and they're both affiliated with the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. Join in by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's get back to the ruffed grouse. Another thing that's been going on is a multi-year study that's been looking at the ruffed grouse in conjunction with the West Nile virus exposure and infection. What was the testing showing on that one? Jamie?
Jamie, I think you're muted.
I think you are. Thank you, David.
Thank you. So this is the third year of a rough grouse West Nile virus surveillance project. It was also jointly conducted with Minnesota and Michigan, although they did not participate this past year. So they were prior, I think, due to COVID, they backed off this last year, and there's one more year of research to go. And the study is really trying to look at or explore rough grouse West Nile virus exposure and infection rates in the Great Lakes region, and also try to identify future research needs in Wisconsin, including the potential for a survival study investigating sources of mortality. And so this past year, the DNR did not distribute additional test kits. So if you're familiar with this project from the past couple of years, the goal is to get test kits into the hands of rough grouse hunters so that they can submit samples after they harvest a bird. And again, as with precautions with the pandemic, they did not distribute additional kits, but kits that were out there were still viable and folks were encouraged to use them or get them to somebody who could. So a small sample size this year, only 36 birds were submitted for testing, and the results showed 20% had antibodies consistent with exposure. And of those samples, 11 had confirmed exposure and 9 had likely exposure. And only one of the samples had detectable portions of the virus present in the heart. And so what does that mean? First of all, we have not really looked for West Nile virus exposure much before 2018, when West Nile virus was, it was in Pennsylvania where we were seeing grouse with West Nile virus antibodies. And so the Midwest started doing testing as well and started looking. So it's important to understand we haven't looked, you know, we just looked recently, and it's likely that rough grouse have been exposed to West Nile virus sooner than 2018. And so the idea is to continue, you know, that these exposures didn't necessarily kill the birds, but it shows that they were exposed to the virus at some time. So whether it kills the bird or not, we don't have that information. And that's where that additional research would come in. So again, we talked earlier about this with diseases or with predators and disease I mentioned, but continued efforts to maintain and create that quality young forest, that thick, dense cover that David referred to, is still our best tool for sustaining the healthy grouse populations in the state. That helps the grouse better handle the stress and impacts of things like disease or even extreme weather events. So there will be another sampling test kits being handed out this fall, and hunters encouraged to, provide samples. And at this point, too, something that folks are often wondering or ask us, but there's no evidence that West Nile virus can spread by handling dead birds or consuming properly cooked game.
Okay, great. Thank you. And we do have another grouse question from Bill in Superior. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, From personal experience, I can't really trust the DNR's counting abilities when it comes to wildlife in the state. I mean, I got in an argument a while ago with a state bear biologist, and she said that northern Wisconsin had the least amount of bears in the entire state, which I know to be true or false. My question is the drumming survey the only way the DNR is getting numbers? Because for every one male that drums, there's, in at least from what I've seen, and because I'm an avid hunter as well, there is multiple other birds, especially young, that don't drum, and females don't drum either. So what is that the only way they're doing it? It seems pretty inefficient.
David, do you want to handle that one?
So the drumming survey is a again, it's not an exact count. It's called an index. So and then as they do the same methodology year after year after year since 1964, that they get a sense about how many birds they hear along each transect route. And again, like you said, it is pretty much a 1-to-1 sex ratio. So for however many males they count, they just double that, and that's the overall sample size from the spring drumming survey. They also do look at brood counts. So they'll look at the brood survival, and brood is the young and the number of chicks. And again, that's not an exact science. It's not an exact count, but it's another data point in terms of how healthy that population is. And then they also, every time you are harvesting grouse, they get a count about the number of birds that are harvested. And so if you put all of that together, again, it's very difficult in wildlife science to get an exact count of any species. That's a free-ranging species. It doesn't matter if it's birds, reptiles, amphibians, mammals, whatever the case might be. But essentially what we're trying to do is get a population estimate with, you know, if you want to get into the statistics, with confidence intervals around that population estimate. And the tighter the population, or the tighter the confidence intervals are. So, for example, if the average, let's just say the average is 444 with a 95% confidence interval of 6 plus or minus, that's a pretty good indication that we've got a pretty solid population estimate versus an average of 444 plus or minus 120. You know, that population estimate is a little bit shakier. And so what they're looking at is a variety of different types of data points and types of data collection to get a sense about how healthy that population is. And primarily in order to be able to say, are we able to sustain a harvest on this population? And do we need to adjust the harvest if we are harvesting it? Can we increase the harvest this year because we've had a really good brood survival? Do we need to decrease the harvest for the upcoming season because maybe the drumming count's down or whatever the case might be? Or perhaps West Nile virus, we're seeing is taking a greater impact on the population. So again, they're not trying to get a direct exact count, but they're just trying to make sure that they're providing a good scientific estimate in order to be able to sustainably harvest and monitor the rough grouse population or any other game population for that matter.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that question, Bill. Ralph in Highwood emailed. He said, in the last 25 years, they have never seen more different groups of new grouse babies and females in recent weeks and heard as much drumming from different males as in the past 6 months. Notable is that they also have plenty of predators around on camera, including coyotes, bobcat, fisher, bear, and hawks. There also seems to be millions of deer in the area. Millions. I think the hunters are going to be headed off in Hayward real quick. Do you have a comment on that one?
I'll take it. Sure. I'll take a first crack, Jamie, and then add in, please. The only thing I was going to mention about that, Jamie, and then I'll let you jump on the rest of that is, you know, this year we had a relatively mild spring and it was a relatively dry spring. And typically what happens with the broods, the young chicks, is when we get a wet, cold spring, you would typically see high brood mortality and you don't have a lot of recruitment into the population. And so that might be part of what's going on is we've had a pretty dry spring and it's been a relatively mild spring. And so there's probably decent brood survival, but that will not account for the millions of deer that are up there. So Jamie, I'll let you handle that one.
Well, I don't know if I was going to comment on the millions of deer, but I would say, I was going to say the same thing, David, a mild winter. We also had a pretty early spring. In terms of phenology, and without having those cold temperatures, that really, really does impact brood survival. So, and just in general, that comment from the gentleman from Hayward is a very positive comment. So seeing that number of grouse broods around from year to year. So,
but it may, I was just going to add on, it may, just to tie this back into Jamie's comment about the ecology. So, you know, if you do have good habitat, you can have a decent healthy predator community and still have, you know, a healthy size prey community, and the prey being, in this instance, the rough grouse.
Okay, great. And let's go to Gianni in Marquette County, who has a question. Hi, Gianni.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Hey, two species and two questions. The introduction of turkeys into Wisconsin decades ago, is there a cause and effect relationship between that introduction and Lyme disease? And the second question is, why am I not seeing honeybees anymore? As kids, we used to have to wear shoes on the clover and the grass because, you know, we step on honeybees. I see very few honeybees now in the last decade. What's going on with the honeybees, and what is the connection between turkeys and Lyme disease?
Yeah, so I honestly don't have a lot to share with you. I am not familiar with connections between turkeys and Lyme disease. I'll kick it back to David too. There are certainly many other species between deer mice or white-footed mice and deer and humans in that connection with Lyme disease, but I have not heard turkeys being part of that. So we'll see if David has a comment there too. And then the other question was about the honeybees, and Phil, PJ Leash would be a really good one to ask that of, but we started the show talking about native pollinators. And as you have, I'm sure, heard, their insect populations are really decreasing as of late. And so that likely has something to do with the number of honeybees, or the notion that you're detecting or seeing that decrease from what you remember as a child. So, David, anything to add?
Yeah, I would agree with Jamie. You know, that Lyme disease connection with turkeys is probably relatively non-existent. The primary vector for Lyme disease are obviously the ticks, and then through white-footed mice, and then white-footed mice are the reservoir for Lyme disease. Deer are not a reservoir for Lyme disease, but they're a very large animal, and they can carry a lot of Lyme disease-infected ticks, which then can fall off of deer and then jump onto humans in that same area that the deer were just in. And so from a turkey standpoint, turkeys are probably non-existent in that cycle there. The only thing I'll say is turkeys are a native species. So there were reintroduction efforts that went on in the state of Wisconsin to boost the turkey population, but they've always been here, and they belong here as a native species, and they've been here as long as Wisconsin's been in existence, and before that. And relative to the honeybees, again, I think there has been a lot of information, and I'll share with you what I know, which is just enough to be dangerous. but there's a lot of information on honeybees and kind of the colony, what's called the colony collapse, and nobody's quite sure about what that is. There's some possibilities with pesticides and nicotoid pesticides in particular. There's also been some suggestions that a particular type of mite has gotten into some of these colonies and actually caused the colonies to collapse. But there is a overall general decline with honeybees and a lot of other pollinator species. That's why that pollinator project is so important. But I'm not sure anybody's completely unlocked the reason as to why they're seeing this colony collapse amongst honeybees.
Okay, and thank you for the call, Gianni. And just as an FYI, we will be covering that particular subject as far as populations of insects and populations of birds that are going down in upcoming shows. So just continue to listen, especially on Wednesdays, and you'll hear more about that. And speaking of birds with, you know, maybe diseases or whatnot, you wanted to mention something about a disease that's going on the East Coast. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So this is really pretty new for David and I to be hearing about this. So there is a mystery bird illness that has been, so the state of Wisconsin has been kind of monitoring the situation since May, and it's been occurring on the East Coast. And so it's starting to get a little closer to home, to the point where the Department of Natural Resources would like to make folks aware and look for your help in reporting sick or dead birds that you may find in your yard. So a little background here. Reports started coming in late May to Virginia, West Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, and now closer in Indiana. In fact, in Indiana, most recently, I believe it was about 50 of Indiana's 92 counties have now found sick or dead birds. And so there's an outbreak of some sort. It seems to mostly affect blue jays, common grackles, starlings, robins, cardinals, brown-headed cowbirds, and other perching birds. There's also some anecdotal, it also seems to be affecting more of the younger birds, so this year's birds. And the symptoms include a crusty eyes, a swollen head, shaking, or the inability to stand. So if you see a bird with neurological signs such as seizures or incoordination, they're asking that you contact your local wildlife biologist. And certainly they are most interested in fresh carcasses or sick or injured birds showing some of these symptoms so we can get them in to be tested. And some of the mystery with this is that the findings and the testing that's been done out east has been pretty inconsistent or inconclusive. So it's challenging that this is not a localized event. And it's also not localized to a particular bird species. And so they do know, for example, that it's not related to salmonella, or if you think about conjunctivitis, where we see it in finches, and it can also often be spread at bird feeders. It's not salmonella. It's not West Nile virus or Newcastle disease, or it doesn't appear to be avian influenza. So again, the more collected specimens we can get, the more data we have. Hopefully we can get a handle on this. Out east, they have actually, federal and state officials have asked folks to stop feeding birds and to stop providing water in bird baths. And again, the reason is those are locations where birds congregate and can spread that disease. That has not been the case, that ask or that request has not come to Wisconsin yet, but I would encourage listeners to be mindful of bird baths and feeders and keep an extra close eye on the birds that are visiting them. If you notice some swollen eyes or crusty eyes, it's time to report that. And I would, as a preventative measure, go ahead and remove those feeders. So we're at a time where native food sources are plentiful. We really don't need to be feeding birds. We do it for our own pleasure. It's not critical. And even sources of water, they have lots of options for getting water. So something to be aware of. And if you see something, report it to the local wildlife biologist.
Okay. David, did you have another comment?
I was just going to quickly say, if you again, as Jamie says, birds don't need our help feeding right now this time of the year. So if you want to just take your feeders down as a preventative, that it would be great. If you do see sick birds, and this is not just for this particular instance, but anytime, you should clean your feeders in a 10% bleach water solution and make sure they're completely dry before you put them out and things like that. The only other thing I'll mention quickly, and again, as Jamie said, this is a complete mystery. It's been going on out east for maybe 3 months or so. Seems to be spreading west. Nobody's quite sure what's going on, but there may be some possible correlation. Again, this is just pure speculation that it might be somehow related to the cicada bloom that occurred out east, because they started seeing, as the cicadas started to increase and come out and become active, they started to see this in birds. And now that the cicada bloom is starting to die off out east, they're starting to see this, at least in the DC and the Mid-Atlantic states, they're starting to see this condition die off in the birds. So they don't know that if it is directly related to cicadas or related at all, but some people are starting to maybe possibly draw a connection between cicadas and this disease that is still a mystery.
Okay, well, interesting. Keep us informed. Let's go back to the phones, and we have Paul in Sawyer with a question. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. I think perhaps these two professors could discuss the ramifications and what's going to happen going forward with the ramrodded legal opinion by an outside interest to to have a predicated on having an immediate hunt of our native wolf predator in this state. Where why did the DNR capitulate and have this statewide overkill of this predator? Because they weren't able to institute a management plan, so it turned out to be a pathetically implemented plan.
All right. Well, thank you, Paul. I think David has an answer for you on that question. David?
I'll start with this. I know Jamie has got some very good information and a really good perspective on this as well. So, it was out of the DNR's control. That wolf harvest that occurred this past winter, that was a political and legal action that the DNR, they had to abide by the judge's orders. They had to go ahead and allow that wolf harvest to occur. And the DNR was in the process of coming up with a very kind of very scientifically based management action to conduct a wolf harvest this coming fall. And it would have been done very professionally and ethically and legally. Again, you know, harvesting wolves is a very emotional issue for many, many people. So, no matter how it's done, obviously, people are going to disagree with it, even if it's done in the most scientific, legal, ethical way, people are still going to disagree with that. And that is just the way that is. So it is very unfortunate that occurred. I think we all agree with that. And the professional scientists certainly agree that was not the way to conduct a wolf harvest. And it'll be interesting to see what happens going forward. But that has actually kind of created quite a few problems for the DNR, unfortunately, because of the legality of that judge's actions. And Jamie, I'm sure you've got some things you'd like to add too.
Sure, I'll just give maybe a kind of an update where we're at in the process right now. So there are two committees active at this point. One is the 2021 Wolf Harvest Committee. And that is, if you've been following along, that would be members of the previous advisory committee and groups who made a formal request to be included in that process. And that committee is charged with providing input on the quota for the fall hunt. So providing input on the quota to the Wisconsin DNR, which will then make a recommendation to the Natural Resources Board. And I believe that will be at their August meeting, which I think is their next meeting. I'm not sure that they meet this month. And then in addition, as that is going on, there is a committee that includes additional stakeholders, includes tribal representatives, and that is looking at the renewing or reviewing and updating the wolf management plan. And so that wolf management plan committee is continuing to meet. That plan is, the target is to have that plan in place in June of 2020. I think it might be 23. I have noted 22, but I want to say it's even longer than that. But regardless, if you go to the Department of Natural Resources website and type in wolf management plan, they have that timeline on the website, and you can follow along in that process. But I believe, you know, the goal going into the fall here, you know, whatever is determined for the quota, I think the goal will be to kind of maintain or keep that wolf population stable until we can get through the finalized or completed management plan going forward. So ideally the management plan would have been done and completed first before, you know, the next harvest season. And there's just not enough time to have that done and done well and be inclusive for all viewpoints and include the tribes in that discussion.
Great. Thank you for that question, Paul. We appreciate that. We're talking about wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Knack. Jamie is an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, and David is an Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor. What questions do you have for them? We have one open line. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can always send us an email, and that address is ideas@wpr.org. Mm-hmm. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us again tomorrow for our monthly home improvement show. We'll be talking about creating outdoor living spaces and using steel framing. That's 11 to 12:30 on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking wildlife. And let's go right to back to the phones. We've got Lee in Green Bay with a question. Hi, Lee.
Yes, hi. This basically is a question for David. I know he does research around the Madison area with live trapping with coyotes and foxes. I have problems with the coyotes getting our fawns on my properties. And my question is, David, how successful are you to get a coyote to go into a tomahawk live trap?
Thank you for the question. Are you in the Madison area, or could you maybe describe your property a little bit more?
My property, I have 20 acres about 15, 18 miles north of Green Bay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me for misunderstanding that. So we have a kind of a research and extension project going on in Madison where we live trap coyotes and red foxes, but we use cable restraints. So we don't typically use tomahawk traps. And for a coyote, we do occasionally catch fox in tomahawk traps, but not very often. And for a coyote, it would probably be a relatively difficult thing to do. So typically with coyotes and red foxes, the most common are either foothold traps or cable restraint traps that you would use. And so in terms of trying to reduce or eliminate fawn predation, from coyotes, it probably is a losing battle, to tell you the truth, because the coyotes are a pretty common animal around the state. And even if you were to catch one or two, there are other coyotes that I'm sure are nearby, either within that pack and other packs, and would move in if you create a void or a hole in that area where no coyotes were. Eventually, other coyotes would move in. And so I think, you know, what you might want to think about trying to do instead is maybe look into what could you do from a deer habitat standpoint to provide maybe some more cover or something like that, so that they have the opportunity to get away from coyotes. But and coyotes certainly do eat deer; they'll eat fawns as well. But as Jamie mentioned with the turkeys, coyotes are kind of an opportunistic feeding machine, and so they'll eat whatever's around, and they don't necessarily concentrate on fawns or deer for that matter. So if they can eat rabbits or bird eggs or smaller mammals or whatever the case might be, they'll certainly choose to do that as well. So you can certainly look into trapping, and trapping is it's an awesome activity, recreational activity. You get to know the animal's ecology and life history very, very well if you trap that animal, if you want to be successful and things of that nature. But I think that you're going to probably have a losing battle trying to trap coyotes to reduce or eliminate fawn predation.
Thanks for that question, Lee. Appreciate that. Let's go to Steve in Stoddard. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
What's your question?
Just a comment for David. David, just to go back to turkeys briefly, you had said that they have been a native species of Wisconsin and that they've always been here. I have to disagree with that just a little. The reason that this turkey that we have, it thrives, is solely due to industrial farming. If you were to be able to take an airplane and fly over Wisconsin, say 400 or 500 years ago, when there was just Indians here, you would have never seen large groups of turkeys from the air. Am I right?
That's not my understanding. If you look at some of the history of turkeys in Wisconsin, if you look at A.W. Schorger, who was a wildlife historian, I mean, he has accounts of turkeys pre-colonial settlement here, and especially down the southern third to southern half of the state, you would have turkeys that were native to Wisconsin or what is now Wisconsin. Prior to pre-colonial settlement, you likely don't have the large numbers of turkeys. The turkey population that we have is certainly due to the way that humans have developed the landscape most recently. But turkeys would have been here for sure.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Appreciate that. Next up is Melvin in Chippewa County. Hi, Melvin.
Hello there. Thank you for the program. I'm seeking commentary, actually, on three very elusive mammals. The first one, probably non-existent and never will again be in the state, the wolverine, which wants snow on the ground most of the year. So that's probably a zero on that. But how about the Canada lynx? Is that known to be breeding anywhere in the state, maybe in some of the counties bordering upper Michigan? And then thirdly, the marten, M-A-R-T-E-N. There have been efforts to reestablish that. Maybe one place was Ashland County in recent times, and maybe years ago on one of the Apostle Islands, perhaps Oak Island. So how is that going with the marten, which the fisher, I think, regularly inhibits its success? So thank you then.
I can take a first cursory stab at those species. So wolverines, and really the caller is pretty much right on all of these. So the wolverine is a species we have not documented in the state for more than 100 years. So they are actually considered an extirpated species. So once native, but no longer here. They're certainly not extinct. They exist in Montana and Canada and places more open, tundra, big expanses, need large blocks of contiguous habitat. Wisconsin's not really a hospitable place for them anymore, or it is a hospitable place. And so there have been some sightings and confirmed sightings of wolverines, but they have all been tracked back to escaped animals from captive facilities. So wolverines, and not a species that I can ever imagine would be reintroduced in the state. We don't have the habitat and the needs and too many people and fragmentation and so on. So that's the wolverine. As far as the Canada lynx, I haven't looked at, you could probably do some searching on the DNR's website, but it is not uncommon for them to be reported a few individuals. I would say since the 90s, there's been a handful that have been sighted, and that's in the northern tier of Wisconsin. You'll probably see a record or two of a auto collision or a vehicle collision where they've had an animal, or from a trapping record, or through perhaps a trail camera. People always think that it's the ear tufts that you look for, but that's not the case. A male bobcat can have pretty lengthy ear tufts as well, but it's the sheer length of their legs and the fur and the furred feet and so on. So lynx certainly are a possibility as a rare species, rare mammal in Wisconsin. And then the marten, he's correct. We do have, first of all, the American marten is our only endangered, it's our only endangered mammal. We have threatened bat species, but it's our endangered mammal. And they were reintroduced. At the same time, there were some reintroductions for fisher in about the 70s. And marten have not fared particularly well. I don't know that we have a definitive answer as to why, but there's some suspicion that there is some competition with fisher. Fisher are more of a generalist. The joke is that they'll eat anything and everything. They get blamed for a lot as well in terms of depredation. But the marten tend to be a little bit more of a specialist in terms of their habitat needs and their dietary needs. And that seems to have some restrictions on their expansion. But there is research going on their reintroductions. We've also had a professor in our department at Forest and Wildlife Ecology who's had remote cameras on the Apostle Islands, and they've detected marten on the islands there as well. So, David, I don't know if you have, any additional of that research to share, but if you looked up Dr. Jonathan Pauly, I think you could come across some of that recent research that his lab has conducted.
Yeah, there's that study going on, and there's the study going on with Tim Van Dielen and the National Park Service at the Apostle Islands as well, the camera trapping project up there. So that's the marten one. I think that the caller was asking also about, is there a sustainable breeding population of Canada lynx in Wisconsin? There's definitely not, for sure. And Wolverines, Jamie's absolutely right. The only Wolverines I see is when University of Michigan comes here to play the Badgers.
Okay. Thank you very much for that call, Melvin. Now, Gary emailed a photo of a red-headed woodpecker, and he wants to know what's the status of the population in Wisconsin. He said he spotted the one in the picture in May at Riverside Park in Milwaukee. There were at least two in the area, and they were the first that he's seen in many years. So in the minute and a half we have before we have to leave, what can you tell us about that, David?
Yep. So redhead woodpeckers are a species of special concern in Wisconsin, and overall their population is declining, and is primarily declining because of habitat loss. So they typically like open habitats, so oak savannas where you have dots of trees here and there with a open pasture or prairie type landscape. They're a cavity nesting bird. So they are, because oak savannas have kind of gone by the wayside a little bit, and a lot of the cavity trees have gone by the wayside, that they have lost their habitat. But interestingly enough, they are coming back. And when they were first being spotted upon their kind of comeback here in Wisconsin and other parts outside of Wisconsin, it was in urban areas and primarily in golf courses, because golf courses kind of replicate an open oak savanna habitat. They don't have that tall vegetation necessarily like you would in a prairie, but you have dots of trees and an open habitat here and there. And there's a lot of older trees on these golf courses that the woodpeckers will start excavating cavities. So they are coming back, but there's still, the population is still in need of help and is still recognized as a species of special concern in Wisconsin.
Wonderful. Thank you for that picture, Gary. It's a really nice one. Those are such pretty birds. We're talking about wildlife with Jamie Nack and David Drake, and we'll be back with more after this look at the news, so stick around. We're talking wildlife with our regular guests, Jamie Nack and David Drake. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Jamie is an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, and David is an Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor. And they're both affiliated with the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. What wildlife questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we've got a bunch of emails that I want to get to, but first, Jamie, you said you wanted to clarify something.
Oh, yeah. So we were talking about turkeys and the history of turkeys in Wisconsin, and I just wanted to kind of clarify the caller and David's comments as well. So turkeys are certainly native to the state of Wisconsin. In fact, there are, you know, historical records of them. They were very important food source for settlers and Native Americans alike. But as a result of settlement, the increase in farming, logging that led to the clearing of the state's oak forests, turkey populations plummeted. That was also in a time of unrestricted hunting. And so hunting itself off likely was a contributing factor. But by the year 1881, wild turkeys were completely void from the state of Wisconsin. And it wasn't then until 1976 that the Department of Natural Resources made a trade. It's kind of an interesting story, but we traded rough grouse from Wisconsin for wild turkeys from Missouri. And I think we probably got the better end of that deal because, long story short, there are now turkeys in just about every county in the state of Wisconsin. And I don't think folks ever thought that they would expand as far north as they have. But the 29 turkeys that we got from Missouri were originally released in Vernon County. And from there, as the turkeys reproduced and populated areas, we actually trapped turkeys within the state and moved them around to other counties. And so over 3,000 turkeys were trapped and relocated to 49 counties. And the rest of the expansion, they did on their own. So it is a very interesting story. So they are a native species. They weren't always here in that they were extirpated. Again, coming back to that word where they were completely void of the state, but then we help them with that translocation or that reintroduction. So
I think it was 3 rough grouse for every turkey. That was the trade.
Okay. Well, thanks for that clarification, Jamie. We did have Greg in Green Bay call earlier, but he couldn't stay on the line. And he was wondering, are there any plans for hunting cranes in the future?
So no, there are no plans right now, but if you subscribe or if you can get your hands on the Wisconsin Outdoor News, there is a 4-part series on sandhill cranes that they're in the process of publishing. And it really looks at the flyway that Wisconsin lands in, compares the information that we have for cranes in our flyway, what that season could look like, how other states are harvesting cranes, but it kind of really lays out the issue, and it is an issue. There's a lot to be considered in terms of what the impacts of a hunting season would be to the crane population. So, and likely there's additional research that's needed. But if you can get your hands on the most recent copies of the Wisconsin Outdoor News, they are running a series of articles on sandhill cranes.
Great. Thank you, Greg. John in Chippewa Falls emailed that he's always had bluebirds in his area, but none showed up this year. Any ideas why?
I can add a comment to that, John. I feel you. I have yet to see a bluebird myself. And so we often get callers who say, oh, I don't have any blue jays this year. Or the next caller says, man, do I have the blue jays? Well, I think there's some truth to the bluebird report in that bluebird sightings and numbers are actually down. And the thought is, if you recall some of the ice storms in Texas and some of the cold snaps this winter, so they typically migrate and are in the southern United States. And there was some really tough winter weather, severe cold and ice, that they likely were impacted on the winter grounds. And so we saw fewer bluebirds returning this year. So another great source of information would be the Wisconsin Bluebird Restoration. I'm sorry, the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin. To go to their website, I would suspect they have an article or something written about the decline. But that is something that people are observing this year, a reduction in the number of bluebirds.
I think another factor right now is because we've been relatively dry in the state and we're actually below normal precipitation levels. There are not as many insects out, and bluebirds are an insect eater. And so they may not be in your area, and there may be fewer, as Jamie indicated, because of some of the events on the wintering grounds. But they also may be congregating in different areas of the state than they normally do, simply because they are probably in areas where there's more water and our insects are near the water. And so the bluebird distribution across the state might be different than it is in years when we have more normal precipitation.
Okay, and then Anna emailed that she'd like to know why the impact of known pesticides isn't emphasized more. Her neighbors, both in town and up in the Northwoods, spray for mosquitoes, treat their lawns for grubs and voles, and many other insects or rodents that are not even part of the ecosystem of their lawns. Why can't we get a scientific voice to openly state that the correlation between these insecticides and declines in bees and other insects is more than just a coincidence?
Well, I think in certain times, you know, what we typically will recommend from a professional standpoint is responsible use of herbicides, insecticides, pesticides, whatever the case might be. You know, certainly follow the package instructions on the back of the label, instructions on the back of the package, and things of that nature. And I think one of the reasons that you don't hear the scientific community coming out in mass and saying banning pesticides is because I don't think that link is there's coincidental information, but I don't think there's a direct cause and effect link for all the downfalls we're seeing with decreasing or declining pollinator species, declining wildlife species. I don't think it's all on the shoulders of increased or even not increased, but just even responsible pesticide use. So I think there's a lot of other things going on. I just don't think, at least that I'm aware of in the literature, that the data supports that it's a direct cause and effect link between pesticide use or herbicide use or insecticide use and a decline in species X, Y, or Z.
Okay, and thank you for that. Before we go to the phones, now there have been several bear sightings in Dane County recently, and a lot of people are a little shocked about that. How unusual is it for a bear to be found in an area like Dane County near Madison?
So it's actually not that unusual, and it's actually becoming more and more common to have a sighting or two or three every year at this time. So the better question is, what's going on at this time of the year that bears are moving around? And typically, bear habitat is in the northern third of the state, in addition to the central forest. But we do see bears quite often roaming around the southern part of the state. But spring and summer is the time when cubs, so we know that the mother bear, the sow, has her cubs in the den during the winter time, and they actually will stay with her for more than a year, so about 18 months. So at this time of the year, so they breed about every other or every third year, sows do, because the young, the cubs, will stay with her for 18 months. So at this time of the year, it's also breeding season. So that mother is pushing those cubs away from her so that she can now be bred again. And so what you have is young male bears wandering and looking to establish their own territory. But you also have breeding season occurring in June and July, and you've got male bears wandering around searching for a mate. And so it's not uncommon to have them wander into an urban area or further south. So the question then becomes, what should you do if you hear that there's a bear in the area or in Dane County or in your neighborhood or there's been a sighting? And the way you want to respond is, first of all, get those bird feeders down, bring them inside. If you've been feeding pets outside or they have access to dog food outside, bring that in as well. Anything that can be an attractant food-wise, those bears are going to be interested in. So garbage as well. Don't put your garbage out until the morning that it's collected. Make sure it's secured in a metal can or in the garage where the bear's not smelling it. So the biggest thing is they're attracted to those food sources. And if you were to happen to walk around the corner and come face to face with the bear, you don't need to drop dead. You don't need to run. But what you need to do is kind of put your hands up, make yourself look big, talk to the bear, let the bear know that you're there. Because a lot of times what happens is you startle the bear. So let them know you're there and then try to back away slowly. You want to be very careful not to corner the bear, provide it an escape route where it can flee on its own, where you've not backed it up into a fenced area or so on. So exit the area, get back in the house, whatever be the case. And again, removing feeders, let your neighbors know there's been a sighting, and if there's no food sources, they're going to move on fairly quickly.
Okay, good advice there. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Rick in Portage County. Hi, Rick. Thanks for holding.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As one of those folks who, when safe to do so, always stops for to remove turtles that are locked up in the middle of the road, I wonder if you wouldn't take the time to instruct people or remind them on how they can actually safely remove a snapping turtle without picking up them up by the tail and possibly injuring them that way.
Sure thing. Okay. Yeah, thank you very much for looking out for the turtles. That is a wonderful thing. A lot of times you'll see turtles, especially in the springtime or late summer, where they're nesting or kind of along a gravel shoulder of a road. And they are, most of the time, if they're just sitting there, they are depositing eggs in a hole that they've dug in that gravel substrate. And then they're going to cover the eggs up and then move on their way. And then once they leave, those turtles they fend for themselves after they hatch out. And they're on their way. But a lot of times you'll see snapping turtles as well as other turtles. And with snapping turtles, people obviously, and rightfully so, want to avoid the head and the mouth in particular because their name is apt. They will snap at you and they can give you a very, very painful bite. So rather than picking them up by the tail, which is not good for their skeletal body, it's either better to pick it up by the side of the shell, on each side of the shell. But if you do that, just be careful of the back legs, because those back legs will be spinning and they can possibly scratch you with their claws. So better yet, pick it up where you have one hand at the front of the upper shell of the carapace, right behind the neck and the head. And that turtle will be able to turn its head, but it cannot turn its head far enough to get your hand caught. And then pick it up at the back end of the carapace, back by the tail part, and you can pick that animal up and lift it that way. They will move around sometimes, so you may have to put a foot, just gently put some pressure by your foot on the shell to hold it in place as you're kind of grabbing the front and the back of the shell. And move it, and typically move it in the direction that they're going. Don't move it in the opposite direction they came from.
I'll add one more suggestion, which involves you not having to touch a turtle at all, which is to go and look in the roadside ditch, see if you can't come across a large stick.
Yeah.
And I would push it across and use the stick to kind of scoot it across the road. So, typically people don't have shovels or tools in the back of their vehicle. But if you do have anything like that too, a rake, something like that, that you can just kind of slide it along the pavement and get it across, that's probably the safest thing you can do. So
that's an even better suggestion, Jamie. Thank you.
We've had a couple of listeners call in and suggest that you take something, again, a stick or whatever, and let the turtle clomp on it with their teeth, yeah, and then bring them over that way too. So is that safe too? Okay.
Right. Yeah, you can do that as well. Sure.
Okay, great. Thanks for the call there, Rick. Let's go to David in St. Croix Falls. Hi, David.
Yes. Say, we go up to a place called Crex Meadows in northwestern Wisconsin quite a bit. Wonderful place to see sharp-tailed grouse, where it used to be.
Yep.
Population's way down, and we're wondering if the pheasants have anything to do with that. I've heard that they lay their eggs in a sharp-tailed grouse nest, and like kind of like a brown-headed cowbird or do. My battery's almost dead here, so I'll listen to your response there. Thank you.
I think it's only right that David answers David's question. So I'll start and Jamie can chime in. So up in the northwestern part of the state, Crex Meadows, that's where you would find sharp-tailed grouse in the state of Wisconsin. And it is a declining population, although they are still a hunted population, which is somewhat interesting. And there is some truth to the fact that ringneck pheasants, which are not native, they're an invasive non-native species to the United States, they will deposit eggs in ground nesting birds. This is common in prairie chickens. They'll deposit nests, eggs in prairie chicken nests in the central part of the state, sharp-tailed grouse nests in the northwestern part of the state. How impactful that is from a negative standpoint, I'm not sure, and I'm not sure how widespread that is, although it does certainly happen. So, Jamie, I don't know if you have anything else you want to add to that.
No, but I think, David, you know, we're familiar with prairie chicken research, too, that there is some direct competition between pheasants and prairie chickens as well, where they can drive them out of an area similar to a mute swan and a tundra swan, talking about an introduced species versus a native species. So, so there's definitely some truth to the caller's comment or concern.
Great. Thank you, David. And since we had a David question for David, how about we have a Jamie question for Jamie?
No
Jamie
way.
And Jamie and Algoma, you've got a question for us.
Hi, Jamie. I saw a monarch butterfly the other day, and there are monarchs all over the place in Algoma. I don't know if they follow the shoreline during migration or what, but we're right on Lake Michigan shore, and there are just tons of them here. Anyway, one landed on a tree right in front of me the other day, and I walked up to it. I was about a foot away from it, just looking at it. And as I was looking at it, it fell to the ground. And it didn't look like it was old, and, you know, the wings weren't tattered or anything. It looked fresh and new. And I gently scooped it up and held it in my hand, and it was shivering all over, almost like it was having a seizure or something. And I just kept observing it. I offered it a little bit of raw honey, and it would not unfold its proboscis or unroll it to take any. I did that with a bumblebee earlier that I'd found and brought it kind of back to life. But after it sat there for maybe 10 minutes, it kind of fluttered and flew a short distance, and it fell to the ground again. And then I picked it up again, and after a little while, it flew away. I thought, what on earth was going on with it? Did it get into pesticides or Do you know what could have been going on with it?
Yeah, I don't know for sure, and certainly am not an insect expert. I would have done the same things you did, maybe sugar water or a piece of watermelon, something like that to offer it, or a oftentimes if you just cut a piece of sponge and dip it in some sugar water mixture and let it perch on that. So you could have hung on to it perhaps for a little bit and gave it time to regroup, you know, kind of come back and then put it back outside. But I would suspect that it likely just in terms of movement, you know, was tired, you know, needed some time to recoup. And it just, again, really brings the show to a full circle here in terms of creating that pollinator habitat that we started off with and how important that patchwork of habitat, even along the Lake Michigan shoreline there, how important that is as these butterflies are migrating, that they have what we call in the bird world stopover habitat through migration. So providing native trees and shrubs, grasses, pollinator plant species, really important to give them a place to stop and safely provide shelter and food for them to refuel.
Great. Well, thank you, Jamie. And thank you, Jamie. And just to let you know, we do have an insect specialist coming in 2 weeks. PJ Leash will be with us 2 weeks from today. So if you have insect questions like that, you can certainly wait until then. Let's go now to Bob in Nebagamon. He's got a question for us. Hi, Bob.
Hey, up here in Douglas County, I got a question. Might seem a little odd, but is there someone that studies porcupines and that kind of animal? We have seen so many porcupines this year. It's unbelievable. I've got a Chesapeake and a lab, and each one has been to the vet at $250 a pop.
Oh, no.
To pull quills up. It just seems, they're fine, but it just seems like there are, is there a biologist that actually studies the numbers of things like porcupines? The numbers just seem high. I'm not complaining. They're cool, you know, but, and the other thing is the comment about the wolf. We need another wolf hunt, period.
Okay. Well, on that note, who wants to take the, porcupine question?
Well, I would suggest, looking up Dick Thiel, Richard Thiel. And he was a biologist for a very, very, he's now retired, but very, very long time at Sandhill Wildlife Area, and did telemetry studies and movement studies on porcupines. And if there's anything in the literature that might be helpful, it'll probably have his name associated with it. So I think, you know, it's hard to say why you're seeing more. It comes down to perhaps habitat. You may have just a number of porcupines in the area that had fairly large litters that they're particularly successful this spring. But when we get into the fall hunting season for grouse and other species, that's where we're going to find out. When we've got hunters on the landscape really moving across large blocks of public land in the north, where we'll see, you know, we'll maybe put some more information anecdotally to whether this has been a really good year for porcupines. Again, the mild winter likely helped them as well survive. More animals coming into the spring to breed and have young.
David, did you have another comment?
I was just going to mention quickly that Dr. John Pauly, who's a colleague of Jamie and mine, we've referenced him earlier in the show about the Apostle Islands and the Martins. He's doing some porcupine research at Sandhill National Wildlife Area, or State Wildlife Area, looking at fisher predation on porcupines and doing some porcupine physiology. So there's another study going on as well.
Okay, great. Well, thank you both so much. Always learn so many things when you come with us. We've been talking about wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Knack. Jamie is an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, and David is an Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor. Join us again tomorrow. We'll talk about home improvement. I'm Jill Nadeau.